history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Each year, Memorial Day gives us an opportunity to pause, to reflect, and to honor and remember the more than 1 million Americans in our more than 240 years of history who have given what President Lincoln called their last full measure of devotion for the sake of freedom, liberty, and the ideals of our country. I know you're used to hearing World War II veterans on this show, but this time we're going to hear a younger voice. He was wounded in Iraq, losing a leg, but eventually gaining a mission to help other veterans in need and to attack an epidemic that is adding more rapidly to the number of those we remember on Memorial Day than anything else, that source of casualties that occur long after our veterans have left the battlefield. It's been said that 22 veterans per day commit suicide. And you'll hear Justin Bond say that because of the way statistics are reported, the real number might actually be higher. It's tragic, and it has to stop. And we're going to hear how Justin and his fellow veterans involved with an organization called Our Heroes Dreams are working hard to stem that tide. But we're also going to hear the incredible twists and turns his own story has taken to bring him to this point, starting with conversations he had as a child with his grandfather, Warren Wooten, who had served in the Merchant Marines in World War II.
Yeah, my granddaddy always would sit there and tell me the stories about what it was like in World War II and show me the scars. And he wouldn't talk to any other grandkids or anybody else, his wife or anybody. And one day he told me, he said, the only reason why I tell you all this stuff is because I know someday you're going to be the one to go in. He goes, someday you're going to carry the torch of freedom. And I can remember 4th of July nights, everybody would be outside. And I would sit in the room with my granddad, and sometimes he would cry. He would turn the TV up loud, and he said, sometimes the bangs bother me, but sometimes it's just the thought and the memory of what our guys went through. And when they celebrate the 4th of July, they don't understand what those bombs in the air mean. He didn't tell a lot, but enough to definitely gain a whole lot of respect for the brotherhood. And that's mostly what he talked about, was the brotherhood. And not patriotism, not for the country. You do it because of the guys that have your back and you have their back. And so I always knew I was going to go in. I always just knew. And when I got old enough, it was natural. And I was homeless at 14, as it was, and different things, living on the street. So as soon as I was 17, I went down and talked to a recruiter, and they helped me get a GED. They got me in. They said, well, you have to have a high school diploma to get in. But they said twice a year we allow GEDs in. And so they did that, and they tested me on the ASVAB and asked me what I want to do. And the very first thing I saw was combat engineering, their book, and I loved it. I was driving a D-8 dozer and playing with C-4. I said, put me in. And pretty soon we were deploying to Bosnia. Actually, what happened was my grandma died. 2 weeks later, my grandpa died. 2 weeks later, my sister died. And they said, man, you're negative a month in the hole for leave, and we're deploying to Bosnia. They said, you can come, or you can get out on a hardship and come back in when you get everything squared away. And I was a mess. When my sister died, that was it. I was a mess. And I said, all right, I'm going to take that option. They let me out, gave me an honorable. I went to work, and I started paving. Ended up getting crushed by a paving machine. Ended up getting crushed by a Ford F-550 and a semi hooking up to tow while I was towing the paving machine. And ended up getting a metal pelvis, hip, and tailbone, and that's when 9/11 happened.
You're killing me, man. And everybody listening, everything you're talking about is like a huge, overwhelming deal for most people, and you're saying it like it's no big deal. You got crushed between a pickup truck and a semi.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it was 3.5 inches thick sideways. The safety chain came down and kept the trucks somewhere between 3.5 and 6 inches thick is what they said. And the truck, the Ford F-550, the wheels were just spinning, and it had me crushed up against the truck with the safety chain, saving it out in the desert. And then somebody came in, got in the Ford F-550, stopped it, and moved it back. So I was pronounced dead on the scene. They actually had video on the news when the helicopter was there, and they said, they kept asking me questions. I couldn't answer it, but in my mind I could. And they said, we're losing him. And one of the doctors that had come out that was driving by, he said, time of death, 5:16. And they covered me with a sheet. And 3 minutes later, they heard the end of my prayer from underneath the sheet. And this was on the news when I saw it on the hospital bed. I was just like, wow, you know, I just died.
So you're conscious when they put the sheet over you and you hear them say, time of death, 5:16.
Yes, sir. I heard it. Couldn't respond, but I knew it was happening. I was praying.
What do you pray?
I just said, Lord, I'm too young. I got a lot. You know, I believe in you, and I want to keep doing what's right out there. Next thing you know, I was awake.
And so they heard the end of that prayer, and they realized you were alive.
Yes, sir.
Should you have been alive?
Well, it's not my call when I leave the earth, I guess.
Basically, your whole body was compressed to 3 or 4 inches thick.
Yes, sir. Complete metal pelvis, hip, and tailbone after that.
No internal injuries, organs?
Yeah, it was all crushed. I was bleeding internally. They rushed me to surgery after I got to the hospital, and again I died on the way to the operating room. They covered me with the sheet again, and the doctor said, he says, I don't believe in God or higher powers. He says, but I wasn't going to be able to save you on the table, but we were going to try. And he goes, you died on the way, and then you came back. And wow. He said, nobody can die that long and come back normal. And he said, so somebody out there did save you.
You're a walking miracle.
Yes, sir.
And we've only heard a part of it so far. So this is happening while you've already been discharged from the Army, and this is right before the attacks of 9/11, 2001.
Yes, sir. I watched the towers fall over and over and over, and all I could remember was going into like a church or an event, and then everybody said, you know, hey, thank you, veterans. Veterans, stand up. And I would never stand. You know, I didn't even finish my first tour. And it cost the country $1 million of training and then left. And so I felt that I had to go back in. For one, all the stories from my granddad would run through my head. And the brotherhood that I did see there and all the training that I had, but I was never able to put it to use. And so I had to. So I went down to the recruiter and they're like, dude, you're in a wheelchair. I'm like, I'm going to get up and I'm going to train. And they just laughed at me. And I knew it was a long shot, but I kept researching online and kept trying to get up. And pretty soon I was on crutches and they said I would never walk again. And pretty soon I found a clause that if you've been out less than 4 years of the military, you can go back in under your old medical. You just have to be able to pass your PT test whenever it comes up. Mm-hmm. So the recruiter put me in under that, knowing the situation, and I somehow avoided all the PT tests leading up to going to Iraq. I found a unit out of Fresno, the Fresno 1072nd National Guard that was deploying, got put in there, ended up finding my way over there without ever having to take a PT test.
Why was it so important to you? I mean, you've almost been killed. Well, you had died a couple times and come back. Why was it so important to you to go over there and serve our country?
It's weird in life how you go through stages. And at the time, watching those towers fall, it was like a bully came over and punched us in the gut. To see President Bush put out the war cry, and to see all the Vietnam vets and the Korea vets, and even World War II vets wanting to go back in, you see that brotherhood. You see that your home is under attack. And as a, well, not an able body, but as a, in my mind, an able body man, ready, I can defend my country. I can do something. You can put me in a turret, and I can defend a convoy. And so I had to go. I didn't have any choice. In fact, the military was trying to hold me out because of my injuries before. My family's like, what are you doing? You can't go. And I'm telling them, no, the military's making me go because I'm prior service. I have to go. And the military's like, dude, you got problems, you know, you can't go. And then the family was fighting me, you know, you're not going, you're not going. And I had a fiance there that was trying to hold me back and a one-year-old son. And next thing you know, I cussed God out. I had a heart-to-heart with them. And I told them, I said, you're not stopping me. I'm going over. I'm doing this without you or with you, but I'm doing this and we'll deal with it on the back end.
Didn't know what you're getting into, did you?
Nope. Be careful what you ask for.
Have you ever had one of those conversations like that since?
On the opposite end.
Yeah. Kind of figured. Yeah. Well, I'm sure we'll get to that. So somehow you end up back in the Army and you're heading over to Iraq. What are you going to be doing over there?
I was going to be a saw gunner on a gun truck escorting convoys in and out of Taji, which is just outside the green zone in Iraq. You know, I love the saw, shoots 760 rounds a minute when it's turned all the way down, even though they're just little tiny rounds, but, you know, compared to a 50 or something like that, it was an awesome weapon to be on. And I didn't care what I was doing over there. You know, it wasn't the combat engineer stuff with C4 and building and blowing up bridges and things like that, like I originally went in for, but I found the closest unit that was deploying and signed up with them.
And you mentioned you're leaving behind a fiance as well as a one-year-old son. Any thought in your mind I might not see them again?
I tried not to think about that, but yeah, I did. Especially the last day when we're getting our final formation and we're heading to the airport from the guard unit. We're heading out to get on the plane, and you see them all over there, you know, and it was like, oh, man, what am I doing? And so I wouldn't even look. I just kept my eyes forward. Walk in formation. You see other people, kids going up to daddy, and you know, and I was just like, oh, shut it out. Mm. But yeah, it was a real thing at that point. We were in Kuwait, and I hated Kuwait. The smell of the oil, the taste of the oil in the food was just horrific. And I thought, man, this sucks. I don't know if I can do combat. Kuwait was horrible, the sandstorms and this and that. And we were there like 10 days, and we got to Baghdad, and we got into Iraq. It all changed. It was desert, but it wasn't sand. And the food was good, and the water was good, and combat was much easier than Kuwait, I think. You know, we got out there, and we had little ladies, 60 years old or so, get out on their hands and knees and kiss our feet and say, God bless you, God bless your country, and God bless your God for you coming to die for me. Mm. We saw the difference even early on in 2004 of how women's rights were starting to change. And so today I look back and I tell everybody, you know, hey, I don't know if we were there for whatever reasons you guys want to say, the oil, the revenge, whatever it may be. Those women are now free. Those women are working in government, in schools. They can choose if they want to be married to that guy or not. And I saw a lot of women die over there, getting beat to death because they just looked at another guy. And maybe that is their culture, but we helped free that up a little bit so that they have the next step of their freedom. So to me, it was worth it.
So your job was to man this gun on some kind of armored personnel vehicle, or what are you typically going out in?
Either a Humvee as a gun truck, or a PLS, palletized loading system, which is the heaviest truck that the Army owns. It's 86,000 pounds empty. You know, a semi going down the road can only be 80,000 maxed out. 10-wheel drive, 6-wheel steering. So every time you turn the steering wheel, 6 wheels move. Just an amazing piece of equipment. You can go in under fire in combat, download a Connex, and pick up a new one and take off in under a couple minutes.
Are you one of several guys doing what you're doing, or are you the only guy that has that job in that vehicle?
In that vehicle, yeah, I was always the gunner. In our company out of Fresno of 144, I think we had 6 SAW gunners. Sometimes I was escorting a general and a colonel. Sometimes we were escorting equipment, or sometimes the Hajis, the Iraqi workers, we'd escort them.
Well, you've got some precious cargo that your job is to protect.
Yeah, and fortunately, training kicks in, you don't think. You know, if a bullet flies or a threat emerges, you don't think. And if you do think in combat, you're dead. You don't have time to think. If you think, is that a bad guy? Boom, you're gone. And so you have to know instantly, and you have to have a clear head. And some of the biggest, baddest people over there that I looked up to so much, you know, my leaders, when the bullets started flying, they started crying. And yet we had females that popped up and proved to be the leaders when the bullets started flying. And so it's amazing in combat to see who's going to emerge. And you never know.
Yeah, not until those bullets start flying, as you said. I mean, what kind of threats are you looking for? It's probably a pretty tense situation, not knowing what's out there and what could be a threat, what's not. What were you looking for?
Yeah, different things, different areas. When you got around Fallujah or those areas, you know, the threats would change. It would be in a like you're in a parade going downtown Baghdad. You're waving. Kids are out there. People are throwing candy to the kids, throwing a set of shoes out to the kids, and yeah, life is good, and it's like a parade. And you get towards Fallujah, and then it goes from waving to people running for weapons. They almost deployed a whole battalion because the guys we were replacing said, hey, we're leaving in a couple days. We can go around Fallujah for 6 hours, 8 hours to get to the back base, or we can go through it, which is too dangerous, but they're not going to be expecting us. We went through it. The generals and everybody got all up in arms. That guy got in a lot of trouble, and they weren't ready for us, or we would not have made it.
Wow. So that was your first experience with Fallujah?
5 days into Iraq, I think, then. So it was pretty new. I was sitting up on the gun truck, and I could hear some four-letter words, and from the front, like, where are you taking us, you know? And the guy's like, don't worry about it, and he was going home the next day, so he was just trying to make sure he got there and back.
Mm. Well, I know that we're going to hear about another time in Fallujah that didn't work out that way, but anything else in the interim from when you first got there to when you were wounded that stands out in your mind that was significant or left a powerful memory with you?
We paid the Iraqis $1 a day and up to $5 a day, and they would work hard for us. They cut your hair, they clean the latrines, they do all kinds of stuff for you, whatever the job that they needed. We hired around 10,000 people a day at our base alone of 30,000. We had a lot of people there. So they work for you during the day, but then we always heard, okay, they could be attacking you at nighttime, and it could be the same ones. Our very first firefight, I was on a deuce and a half, and I had a female driver. We're coming back from Mosul, the most northern base by the Turkish border. And we're coming back, and we're, you know, like, whoa, what is that? And I don't have any armor at all. No protection, no armor. I'm in the back of a deuce and a half bouncing around just trying to keep my sitting upright. And they're here, Bond, who are you firing at? And I said, I didn't fire at anybody. Go up the road a little bit and jeez, it's so close. He can smell the gun smoke. Bond, who are you firing at? I said, I'm not firing at anybody. And I said, can you smell the gun smoke? She said, yeah. I said, well, we're going forward. It's in front of us then. It's beside us. And I'm trying to reason with her. And I'm watching. I don't see anybody. Mm. Who do you fire at?
Mm-hmm.
So next thing you know, they opened up on us. And it was tracers going way above us. The insurgents pay them $100 a day to attack a convoy. We pay them $1 a day to work hard for us. The insurgents pay $100 a day. It's hard to compete with that.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, multiple firefights where they didn't want to hurt us. They never hit the vehicle.
But they're just firing so they get paid, but they're purposely missing you.
Yes, sir. We had our 50 gunner, and a lot of times bullets would fly, and he would never fire around. Everybody's, why aren't you firing? They're not hitting us. Mm. They're totally missing us on purpose. And so he would recognize that. Well, he was like 6'6". He could have a better view than most of us, but...
Well, that sounds all great and wonderful. That, you know, it's comforting to know that people are not trying to hit you. But doesn't that mess with your bearings and your sense of what? And, I mean, does it give you a false sense of security?
It does, because your natural reaction is, they're firing, I have to fire back. You know, the people you can see the next day during the day when they're working for you, they won't look you in the eye. You know, and you're like, you're the one, you know. You've been out attacking our convoys. The $5 that we might pay them a day if they're higher educated, or the dollar a day, that will feed their families for a week, 2 weeks. Think about that $100.
Yeah.
Think about what that's going to do for their family.
Yeah, hard to resist, I'm sure.
Yeah.
It's time for our first break, but when this special Memorial Day edition of Hometown Heroes continues, we'll hear about a day that came so close to claiming Justin Bond's life, instead leaving that life forever changed, and leading to the mission he's on now to help returning vets and prevent suicide. Learn more about his organization, Our Heroes Dreams, at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.